Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Covers are coming on. It's not raining, but it looks as though it might any minute. So, Mark Kermode, good afternoon to you.
On the subject of that news story about they're recording the fastest album ever, I, of course, quote to you from the Ruttles. The Ruttles' first album took 20 minutes to record. The second took even longer.
The difficult second.
It is.
So this is a 50-minute conversation which might extend.
Depending on the weather.
Depending on weather. So I don't know what speed you're going to have to go at.
Okay.
Let's do the box office top 10, first of all. This week at 10, The Cave.
I don't understand The Cave. It's like it costs $45 million, and it's about a bunch of people going down to a cave and being chased around by beasties, and it stars Cole Hauser, most famous for being Wings Hauser's son. On the other hand, for a mere 4 million of your English pounds, The Descent, the best British horror movie of the year, and shaping up to be one of the best horror movies of the year. Of course, Wolf Creek comes out next week, and you know that's going to be out on DVD. If you didn't see it in the cinema, catch it on DVD. They're the same movie, except The Descent, really good, really scary. The Cave, not really good and really scary.
Number 9, The Adventures of Shark Boy and Lava Girl in 3D.
It's the 3D that's the problem. I mean, critics have been very snotty about it. The story itself is fine. I think it's a good kid's fantasy. It's very even-handed, good role models for the girls as well as the boys. The problem is they've done that red-green 3D thing, which just turns everything into mush brown. And, I mean, you end up with a headache, which is a real shame.
Number 8, Herbie Fully Loaded.
I like it. And I confess this, I was crying in that final race when Herbie... No, I'm sorry, you like Herbie, right?
It's yes, a classic. I don't cry, do you?
You like Lindsay Lohan.
Let me just say the applause here
is for Herbie.
At the Oval. No, it's not, and it's not for your reviews, because the England's women's cricket team, who've won the Ashes, already are coming out and they're being presented to the crowd. That's why there's lots of loudspeaker noise and appropriate applause. So Herbie at 8, Bewitched at 7.
It's rubbish. And unbelievably, you know, taking a television show that was at least sort of vaguely satirical and witty and killing it absolutely stone dead by making a film about the remake of the television programme. I mean, it's so self-referential as not to be, and it's awful.
Number 6 is Crash,
which I really, really like, and people keep confusing this with the David Cronenberg Crash, but in fact it is possible to review both movies equally. Both movies are about the human condition. Both movies have been wrongly maligned by snot-nosed critics, and both movies are worthy of your attention.
5, The Business,
which is the new Nick Love movie. I presume that James reviewed this last week, because I was off last week. And basically, it's about a bunch of really leery geezers. They're all, yeah, well, you know, and they're all running around, they're dealing drugs, they're all really lovable, they're all really great. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, you know, I hated them the first time round. I hated the 80s in the 80s. Why do I now have to watch a movie telling me that actually they're all really great? You know, it's really great. It's much, much less interesting than Love's previous film.
And an 18 because of the drugs?
Because of the drugs, because of the swearing, and presumably because of the clothes, which really do need an 18 rating.
Dukes of Hazzard at 4.
I mean...
It's rubbish.
Yes. Okay. Where do you even begin?
Charlie the Chocolate Factory at 3.
Loved it. Also loved the Gene Wilder, but I really liked the Tim Burton, except for the songs.
Red Eye at 2.
Which I like very much. Wes Craven doing a sort of, you know, good old nuts and bolts thriller. It's good to see it taking money.
And the UK's number one movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, straight to the number one.
Yeah, what did James think of it? I wasn't overly taken with this, I have to say.
He thought...
More interesting than it could have been.
Yeah, he also thought that the whole poster campaign was very
completely
misleading.
Completely misleading.
Because actually what it makes you think this is just about a geek, but yes, actually it's not.
Well, it is a movie that does have some sort of, you know, moral questioning in it. The problem with the poster campaign is it makes it look like Porky's or Revenge of the Nerds or something like that, and it isn't. And so I suspect that what will happen is a lot of, you know, the adolescent audience will go along and wonder why on earth we're meant to be interested in a 40-year-old virgin. And the answer is, well, it's a different film.
We have compulsory attendance in our house this weekend at the Travelling
Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants.
So tell me how great that is.
Pants.
Oh, okay.
But then again, but you know, I was going to say, because I really hated The Parent Trap, but then of course The Parent Trap did go down well in your household.
Fantastic.
That's fine.
We spoke to Natasha Richardson this week.
And in fact, I am willing to go back and see The Parent Trap again now to rejudge it, but I guarantee you that The Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants was pants the first time round, and it would be pants the second time round.
What's new this week?
Well, let's start with, because the sporting venue, Cinderella Man. Now, you probably knew this already, but it's...
First and for free with 5 Live.
Oh, well, there we go. So you did know this already. The life story of James J. Braddock, of whom I had not heard. Now, I have to stress this. His story is apparently legendary. Personally, one of the reasons I like the movie, which is directed by Ron Howard, of whom I'm a big fan anyway, you know, he came on the show, he was very nice, we liked him very much, is that I had no idea how this story ended. Now, I'm presumably, I suppose, by judging by the posters and the general schmaltziness of the advertising campaign, one could have taken a guess, but I didn't know. Consequently, the story of this guy's rise and fall, and then re-rise, and then how's it all going to end? Because it ends up with him going into a fight, having lost everything. It's all in Depression-era America. Central character played by Russell Crowe. He loses everything. He then gets back the right to fight again, and he ends up in a fight in which it is entirely possible that he may actually lose his life. I mean, there's no question he's going to win the fight, whether he'll actually get out of the fight alive at the end of it. Now, not knowing the ending, I was very excited by the way it actually ended. However, I notice in many people's reviews that in the way in which they refer to the story, they tell you the ending at the very beginning. They say, the story of James Braddock, famous for blah. Well, OK, so if you don't know the story, don't read the reviews. Presumably you knew how it ended already.
No, I didn't. No, I have heard about him, and I have read stuff about the movies, but...
OK, fine. Well, look, now, I've always been very, very ambiguous about Russell Crowe. When he's good, he's very good, and when he's bad, he's just a shouty, annoying git. And this is him on very, very good... No, I wouldn't say it in the same room as him, because obviously...
No, I was thinking it applies to so many people.
OK. So, as I said, on the plus side, I think one of Russell Crowe's best performances, I mean, I love Russell Crowe in Romper Stomper. I thought he was great in that, which is a, you know, an often wrongly maligned film about skinheads. I thought he was really, really good in Gladiator. I thought he was not very good in A Beautiful Mind, which is the film he made before with Ron Howard.
That's because you prefer Paul Bettany.
Yeah, no, but I also thought Paul Bettany gave a better performance. I mean, and actually in this film, oddly enough, Paul Giamatti, who is the co-star, gives at least an equally good performance as Russell Crowe. Paul Giamatti plays his manager, his friend and manager, who kind of masterminds his re-rise after the fall, and he's great. Renee Zellweger is in slightly annoying Renee Zellweger mode. I mean, I actually quite like her sometimes, but sometimes she can be fantastically drippy, and she is fantastically drippy in Cinderella Man. They're singing, so that's what you can hear in the background.
Yeah, it's Jerusalem. It's a fairly standard thing.
But that's what happened last time when we were in the middle of the film review. Suddenly there was the bellowing strains of Jerusalem.
Yes.
Okay.
It kind of got used, but then we could shut the window.
Okay, on the downside, it's 144 minutes too long. It's 144 minutes, and it is too long. I beg your pardon.
It should have been 30 seconds long.
And whilst watching it, I spent the whole film thinking, if you let me loose in an editing suite with this film, I could fix it by taking out half the scenes when people stand around and say, I love you, Daddy. Yeah, I love you too, honey. You know, if we all pull together, we can get through this. And there's one classic scene which is indicative of all the problems, in which Renee Zellweger, who plays his wife, goes into a church to pray for him as he's about to do the fight. And she goes into the church, and the priest is standing at the back, and she says, I'm here to pray for James. And the priest turns to the congregation, and he says, so are they. And you think, oh, how moving. And then he says, they all think he is fighting for them. You go, no, Ron, you had me at so are they. You don't then have to go the extra yard and explain why, because I actually... And that is the problem with the film, is it does do the Ron Howard over-egging thing. But I did think the fight sequences are absolutely astonishing. You really do feel like you're having your head kicked in the ring. And like I said, if you don't know the ending, don't read anything about it, because I did actually spend a lot of the last 30 minutes of it gripping the chair.
So you liked it more than you were expecting?
I really liked it much more than I expected. I expected it to be much more saccharine than it was. I do think it's too long, but I was pleasantly surprised, and I thought Russell Crowe really gave his very best, which is good to see, because when he cruises on autopilot, I think he can be very disappointing.
Thank you. Email says, went to see Cinderella Man on Monday, courtesy of Five Lives, first and for free. Absolutely loved it. I'm not a Crowe fan, but I thought he was amazing in this, possibly his next Oscar. Renee Zellweger and Paul Giamatti were great in support. The fight scenes, very powerful.
The fight scenes are extraordinary. I mean, I know one should never casually make comparisons to Raging Bull, because that is like comparing something to Citizen Kane or, you know, or 2001 or something, but they really are extraordinarily good.
Okay, that was from Sarah Hill. She says the whole film is beautiful. Thank you very much indeed. 85058. What else is that?
The Aristocrats. The Aristocrats is the...
Not the Aristocats.
No, although, funnily enough, the Aristocats gets mentioned in the Aristocrats because everyone... Because, here we go. The Aristocrats is the two-word punchline to a very long, very obscene, very disgusting joke that apparently dates back to the days of vaudeville. It's a gag that comedians would tell to each other. It has a very short setup, which is a guy goes into an agent's office, says, I've got this act. And then he describes this act that he does on stage, which is however much depravity one wants to describe. And then at the end, and I'm not giving this away because they say this at the beginning of the film, at the end, the agent says, that's terrible, what do you call it? And he says, the aristocrats. Now, apparently, amongst comedians, who I have to say can be a fairly humourless bunch, this has become a test between them to see who can do the grossest, the nastiest, the vulgarest, the most offensive, the most obnoxious version of this joke. And now we have a documentary, which is literally a one-joke film in which everyone, from Whoopi Goldberg to Robin Williams to, well, basically George Carlin, I think there are 100 comedians in all.
Eddie Izzard's in there?
He is in it, although, interestingly enough, Eddie Izzard sort of kind of refuses to tell the joke, and I think he's on smart ground. Anyway, on the upside, okay, the joke itself is never funny. It's not meant to be funny. The thing is meant to be how, you know, different comedians tell the jokes in different ways, and this tells you something about the different comedians. And that's kind of interesting. There's a little bit of discussion about how there's a difference between shock and satire and the way in which comedy pushes our boundaries, and that's kind of interesting. And then there's an awful lot of a bunch of self-obsessed, miserable comedians talking about how the joke is like a jazz riff and like the way in which we improvise on it is like John Coltrane. And you go, no, it's not. It's a rude joke. And you're telling long versions of it, and, you know, it is a certain amount of, you know, verbal waving your bottom in the air that's involved in that. But it's not as big and clever as you think it is. And the problem with it is, apparently, the longest version of the joke was strung out for something like 90 minutes. Well, the movie itself is virtually 90 minutes. And by about 45 minutes in, I was thinking, okay, I have now heard every version of this joke. I've seen a South Park cartoon version. I've seen somebody miming it. I've seen somebody doing it with a ventriloquist doll. I've seen somebody doing it as a card trick. And I think what's most bothersome is that when they go off into their, I'm really going to push the boundaries of shock, the stuff that they talk about is actually incredibly conservative. I mean, I did spend an awful lot of it saying, you know, thinking, if you really want to shock me, do something that I don't expect. But in fact, that's not what happens. So it's not uninteresting. There are good things about it. But at 90 minutes, it certainly overstays its welcome. And there's a thing at the end of it which says, right, now you've heard the joke, tell us your version for inclusion on the DVD. I think, you know, believe me, after a 90-minute movie about it, the last thing I want to hear is every internet nerd's version of the joke.
Here at the Oval, players coming out again, so even though the covers came on, there was no rain. It's still very cloudy, still pretty dark, but the Australian batsmen are working their way out. Phil Tufnell, a number of people here, including Mandy Fairfax in South Wales. What's Phil Tufnell's favourite film?
My favourite film is... Oh, gosh.
Would you like me to come back to you? I either know it instantly or you don't.
Really. I will say Apocalypse Now.
It's not a bad choice. Which version?
I don't know. I can't really remember what... I was a bit hungover, I think, when I was watching. The one when...
Is it the version that ends with the bridge and the bombing of the bridge, and is it the 70mm print? I'm sorry, this is a terribly nerdy question, but doesn't matter. Apocalypse Now, good choice.
Good choice.
I'm not sure how long we've got, Mark, but you've got...
Can I do Green Street very quickly?
Yes, well...
Have I got time for that?
Well, keep going until I say stop.
Basically, here's the deal. Green Street is a film about football hooliganism. It is an American-Anglo co-production directed by a German woman, starring Elijah Wood as a Harvard graduate who gets kicked out of Harvard, comes to England, joins the West Ham firm, and discovers that actually the salvation of his life is in football violence. He discovers this by hanging out with Charlie Hunnam, who is doing a worse Cockney accent than Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, blimey.
It is literally like, yes, we are speaking Cockney rhyming slang over here, me old man. I mean, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm sorry, I mean, I've heard bad Cockney done by Americans and done by, you know, by people that... But how on earth do you justify this?
Mark, feel free to take as long as you like. The players are walking off.
Very good.
Johnny
okay.
Saunders, hang on. They all came out again.
Yes.
They're off again.
This is where cricket really does itself no favours.
Every ball bowled in this 5 days, because I don't think it's going to go the full duration.
So you were saying about earlier.
No, listen, it's perfectly fine, because in that case, because we have got a clip of Green Street, and I know I just did my impression of Charlie Hunnam. You can hear, because I think this is what the clip is of, the majestic acting talents of Green Street. Here we go.
We apologise for the word that slipped through there, which probably shouldn't have. We thought we might have had some rude words when we faded up the wicket microphone earlier. We got through that. We didn't get through that film, which clearly, Mark, is not going to be worth the hassle, is it?
No, it isn't.
We had Elijah on the programme. I hadn't had the choice of seeing the film, but every single review has said that, well, it's either very offensive or it's hilarious?
Well, there are I think the thing about it is it would be really offensive were it not so badly done. On the one hand, there is just the lunacy of Frodo goes to football. I mean, that is what you keep thinking. Even when he's in the middle of these, you know, you think, I'm sorry, I can't take that seriously. The worst thing about it, however, is that I think it does have an underlying ideology, which is that actually there is something good about this gang mentality. I mean, I have here the director's statement by Lexi Alexander, which says, the reason I made this movie is you never run, you never leave your friends behind. Getting arrested and not remembering anyone's name when the police question you, that's love. Standing next to your friend strong when 30 other guys are facing you, want to punch your face, that's... No, I'm sorry, that's not love, that's football hooliganism. And only somebody who had a ludicrously romanticised view of it could have made a movie that you know, attempts to endorse it in this way. I mean, there is literally a bit at the end of the film when Elijah Wood hopes that he can live up to the fabulous legacy that he has been left by Charlie Hunnam's character. It would have been really, really offensive were it not for the fact that you just spent the whole film with your jaw on the floor thinking, I cannot take any of this seriously.
Well, so why did... Because it was nice talking to Elijah Wood, you know? I mean, obviously
he's a very nice chap.
And he's made his name in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
He must have been attracted by something.
Well,
he can pick and choose.
One presumes that he thought what he was doing... I mean, it's a decision, I have to say, made by an outsider. Somebody looking into somebody else's culture and thinking, that looks interesting and authentic. And clearly, because Lexi Alexander clearly has some kind of experience of the world which she is describing, I think he's just been... I think he's made a very bad decision. I mean, I really do think it's a film whose morality, if there is a morality, in amidst the nonsense. I mean, the final punch-up in it reminded me of the final scenes of Braveheart. I mean, I half expected somebody to shout freedom whilst being tortured on a rack by fiendish English. I mean, it is really that level of dumb. And I'm sure that everyone involved in it recognises it for the clunker that it is. But it would have been offensive had it not just been so bad.
No play at the Oval and the covers are on. Australia 112 for no wicket. Julian Waricker here with Drive, and England need a talismanic change of presenter, so that's what will be happening. And it'll all be fine once Julian takes over. All Mark's reviews are available on download, of course, in case you miss any of them. The accents, then, the fact that they're hopeless sounds like the least offensive thing in it. Because my favourite hopeless accent is only very, very brief, but it's the lookout in Titanic.
Oh, when he says, "Gor blimey, iceberg!
Yeah,
enormous great iceberg ahead, governor!"
Yeah, he almost inserts Mary Poppins in there just to make us realise that it is a really rubbish accent.
Yeah, no. The thing with some of the accents in Green Street are, of course, you know, genuinely quite well done. But if you put Green Street in the canon of great films about football hooliganism, which obviously The Firm, the Alan Clark TV film, which is clearly the best of the genre, Phil Davis's ID, which I think is largely underrated, The Football Factory, which is the film that Nick Love made before he made The Business, which I think is far too leery for its own good, is a much better film. I just think that it's an embarrassing footnote. It does, like I said, the worst thing about it is that it is completely muddle-headed in its philosophy, but even to think about its philosophy implies that you have to take it seriously. And I don't take Elijah Wood getting a West Ham tattoo and drinking 58 pints of lager and going, "Ooh, all right.
He's also 2.5 foot tall.
I know, he's Frodo. God bless him. He's a great little elf. But you know, I just don't buy it. I mean, Ray Winston and all those kind of people. You want to do those, you know, those hard nut characters, I buy, but not Elijah Wood. Nor, incidentally, do I buy the fact that apparently the West Ham firm think that the most terrifying and worrying thing about Elijah Wood is that he does journalism. See, when they find out that he's a journalist, that's when they know he's a ripen. He really is.
I'm very... Now, bearing in mind what happened with our clip of...
I'm really...
..that film, I'm quite nervous about what happens with the rest... Unless we've got clips of the Sister of the Travelling Pants and Bewitched.
Yeah.
How confident should we be about the rest of our clips?
It's the longest yard. So, well, let's have a go. Shall we?
Do you think?
Shall we?
Okay, all right. Well,
no, let's not. Fine. Okay, so I'll just describe the longest yard to you.
I'll tell you what, let's talk about it. Someone important will check it, and
yes,
then someone will give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Okay.
Okay.
So The Longest Yard is a remake of a film called The Longest Yard, which is a great Robert Aldrich movie from the, I think it must be early 1970s, late 1960s, released over here, I think, as The Mean Machine, then remade as The Mean Machine very, very badly. And the story... in both versions of the film, because the second version is actually fairly faithful to the first version of the film, is that Adam Sandler is an American football player who has, at the beginning of the game, thrown a game. Therefore, his life has fallen into disrepute. He has a row with his girlfriend. He gets arrested for stealing a car and drunk driving. Anyway, he ends up in prison. In prison, the prison is run by a very sinister prison guard. Incidentally, played by Mr. Cromwell, who, of course, is the really lovely farmer in Babe, which will always be a problem
for
me.
I'm a bit disconcerted. By the way, we were right not to play the clip.
Were we?
Just for your information.
Okay, fine. James Cromwell, who was the...
Good choice. Good call.
Stop putting me off. I'm trying to keep a straight face. Okay, he was the farmer there. So, basically, Adam Sandler goes into the prison. The prison guard, the prison warden has got a football team that he wants Adam Sandler to coach. Adam Sandler doesn't want to coach it, but he decides that actually what he can do is put together a team of prisoners to do a tryout match for the coach's team, which will give the prisoners a chance to get their own back against the heinous guards. The guards, of course, this being the movie that it is, are all brutal and evil and bad. The prisoners are all huge but downtrodden. And if they get to play in a game of American football, they will get... you know, to sort of rock with it. Now, of course, as we all know, American football is a slightly girly game, which as soon as anyone gets touched anyway, everything stops and they all have to walk away and go and sit down for 28 minutes. And I've never understood films about American football because they keep saying there's only 4 seconds left in this game, and then the film goes on for like 10 minutes and then one team will be leading 97 points to nil, but it'll all be on the last kick. I mean, how is this possible? Adam Sandler kind of redeemed himself for me with Punch Drunk Love, which I think is, you know, one of the loveliest films of last year. I really, really liked it. I thought he did a brilliant performance. But up until then, it had all been, you know, Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore and all those stupid, dunderheaded, clunky movies. Well, in The Longest Yard, it's not even the dunderheaded comedy of yore. I think it's actually trying quite seriously to be a powerful action-adventure movie with some jokes in it. So, in as much as you had before the spectacle of Elijah Wood being a West Ham soccer villain, soccer hooligan. Mm-hmm. I think actually the two things are probably, you know, villain and hooligan, I think,
that'll
are probably
do.
Interchangeable. You now have to believe that Adam Sandler is a celebrity football player who then manages to cut it in prison to get together a prison. Now, of course, Burt Reynolds, who is in the original, turns up, does a cameo role in this one. Again, it's like all Burt Reynolds cameo roles. His face is a very strange mixture of old and lifted, which therefore gives him creases that move away from his eyes in straight lines. So it's like somebody's holding one of those see-through
rulers. Like curtains?
Yeah, but it's like somebody... You know those see-through rulers you used to get in school?
Yeah, still
like,
can,
it's like
yeah.
Somebody's holding them over his head. It is the strangest thing. There are no laughs. There are many, many jokes about men in showers together, none of which are funny. There's loads and loads of boring sports footage of people running into each other and whacking each other over the head and doing that sort of thing, which is uninteresting. Adam Sandler is not lovable in the slightest from beginning to end. And at the very end, when there is some kind of emotional payoff, which is that he has made a great sacrifice to go ahead with the game, it turns out that the great sacrifice he hasn't made anyway, and everyone's forgiven, and then the film stops. And it's incredibly long and incredibly boring and incredibly dull and exactly what I expected it to be. It was a stinker.
You're listening to Five Live at the Oval. It's 20 minutes to 4 o'clock. There is no play. Johnny Saunders is with us as well. And all the covers are coming on now, Johnny. We've got the big green sheets. I'm sure you can give me a technical term, which are covering almost all the playing area.
That's fine. No.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, obviously, he's right up to the mark, Bill. He thinks he knows when exactly the clouds are coming over when the rain is, and maybe he's got one this right, but we haven't got any rain out there at the moment, and as we speak, the covers are coming off again.
Can I just say, on the subject of sitting here, just watching, you know, a bunch of people put some covers on the grass, take the covers off the grass, put them on the grass, take them off, believe me, this is a million times more exciting than Last Days, the Gus Van Sant movie, which came out last week about the last days of Kurt Cobain, which I imagine James reviewed.
Yes, we did. And we spoke to a bloke who
Michael Pitt.
Yes. It was a four-minute interview. It was about 3 minutes too long.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know what James said about the movie. I hope he hated it.
He did hate it.
Okay, it is the worst film of the year by quite some distance. I mean, it's worse than Devil's Rejects. It's worse than Curt and Courtney. You know, the Nick Broomfield movie, which already, you know...
Let's not go back there.
No, but already that's inspired one terrible film. And I'm sitting there watching Last Days thinking, this is actually worse than Curt and Courtney because I'm not even... But all that happens in it is that Michael Pitt, your man, I don't know what he spoke like in the interview, but he spends the movie wandering around, seeing, you know, Kurt Cobain in his last days, although he's not called Kurt for legal reasons, he's called Blake, presumably, as in William. And he mumbles to himself, and he goes,
we could have a clip of that movie.
Yes, exactly, because he can say what he likes. Nobody. When I saw it in Cannes, the only way I could understand what he was saying was to read the French subtitles, because they subtitle all movies into, because obviously it's in France, so they believe that they should at least make some kind of effort. Reading the French subtitles, you know, Le Chat, Le Singe, Monsieur Chevaux, and his De Chevaux, and translating them back into English. And then when you've actually done it, you realise that what he's saying is, I can't make macaroni cheese. And you wonder why you made the effort. I mean, it was mind-pulverisingly terrible. And I see that some highbrow critics, like The Guardian, gave it 5 stars. It is the worst film of the year. But, I mean, it's suicide glorifying navel gazing garbage, and Michael Pitt's performance, it's like, you know, somebody put a plastic bag over their head for 5 minutes to the point that they were sort of almost on the point of losing consciousness and then wander in front of a camera. And there's one brilliant scene in which Michael Pitt wanders through this garden and the camera is following him, and then the camera gets distracted by a tree, and then it looks at the tree for about a minute, and you're sitting there going, I know the tree is more interesting than Michael Pitt, but it's a tree.
Is it so?
It's really bad.
So
and this is, I mean, compared to that, this is like watching Rollerball.
Right. So watching Covers here,
infinitely preferable. Slightly shorter, and there's a lot more sort of, you know.
Here's an exciting bit for you now, Mark.
They're coming off again.
Yeah, that's right. But there's tension. There's drama. Is it going to rain? No, it's going. They're going to get them on and on. You know, what's the grass going to look like when it comes up? Oh, it's still green. That's really well. Honestly, Bill, that is more than is happening in Last Days, when it's just like, is he going to make the macaroni cheese? Yes, he is. How long have I been here for? And it, you know, it's just awful. And then at the end, it ends.
I'm going to go and see it tonight.
No, you're not.
You.
No, I tell you, believe me, I'll actually pay you. I will pay you to suffer it. I will pay you, because I've always said that the judge of being a good film critic is not how many good films, any idiot can see good films. It's how many really bad films have you seen. It's only when you've seen Exorcist II, The Heretic, that you understand the value of good filmmaking. It's only when you've been right down in the slough of despond, in the depth of despair. This is a sporting thing.
Okay, so if I had to choose between this Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants or Last Day...
Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants is... You know, Citizen Kane, The Exorcist, Mary Poppins, all rolled into one, in one huge, action-packed, vibrant, life-affirming package of fun in comparison with Last Days. I mean, Last Days is unspeakably poor.
We got that impression. We spoke to Natasha Richardson on the programme. She was absolutely delightful.
Sure.
It sounds like her movie Asylum. Sounds, I don't know, you'll probably use the word gritty in there.
No, I won't. No? I mean, gritty is a word I would love to use in conjunction with Asylum, but unfortunately camp and naff are much closer to the truth. Now, listen, I'm sure...
It could be camp, naff and gritty.
No, it couldn't. No, no, it really couldn't.
You're probably in the band. That sounds like a
camp,
band,
naff,
actually.
Yes, exactly. Then they have a rap album.
Almost
called Straight Out of Compton. But, okay, so the setup for Asylum, which is based on a novel by Patrick... I presume you say McGrath, not McGrath. McGrath.
Doesn't matter, does it?
Okay, fine. And it's a 1950s setting, apparently. I say apparently because it says in the notes that it's 1950s, but all that happens in the film is that at one point a red Routemaster bus goes by. So you think, oh, fine, period setting because it's a Routemaster bus. And then when there's a lot of, you know, people having sex in it, and when they do it in vintage underwear. So you think, okay, that must be a period setting. So it's late 1950s. Natasha Richardson is a repressed, uptight wife whose husband takes over an asylum. The asylum is sort of semi-run by Ian McKellen, although he's not actually the head of the asylum. He wants to be head of the asylum. But there is a patient who is called Edgar. Edgar is brooding. Edgar is dangerous. Edgar spends a lot of time fixing things, sawing bits of wood, hammering in nails in his vest. He has greasy hands. She spends a lot of time looking at him, longingly, simperingly, temptingly. Finally, they can no longer stand the tension between each other. He smears his greasy hand over her lipstick. Stuff ensues. And then, of course, it all goes terribly histrionically, psychologically wrong, and everything falls apart.
We could have told her that.
Well, of course. Now, apart from the fact that clearly the beginning of it is Lady Chatterley's lover and the rest of it, there was a British horror movie in 1972, I think, called Asylum, which was like a portmanteau film. And one of the stories in it, which is really great, is that there is a lover who... The man that she's going out with has dispatched his wife and hidden bits of her in the freezer. But, of course, it being a British horror movie, the bits all come back and come and attempt to strangle him. That was actually as gritty and realistic as Asylum thinks it is. It's very earnest, and I'm sure that the novel itself makes some more sense. The film itself veers between the silly and the outright camp. Sir Ian McKellen is just absolutely, he's in pipe-chewing form all the way through. He's meant to be this sort of this fiendish character who's kind of manipulating all the things. And it's all he can do to stop from going, ah, ha, 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 you know, putting an eye patch over one eye, having a parrot on it. I mean, it is that kind of, it's British acting with thespians showing you how they can act and people suffering a lot and then stuff of people scrabbling around on cold stone floors. You know the new version of Pride and Prejudice?
Yes.
And everyone has said,
I haven't seen it, but apparently
well,
it's great.
Well, it's fine. It's okay.
No, it's Knightley in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is all right. But the thing that everyone says about it is, oh, they've really gritted up the English countryside. You know, they've really taken Jane Austen and given it a grit. And I'm sitting there looking at this lovely pastoral countryside with a little bit of rain and a rainbow, and thinking, I'm sorry, if that is gritty, you really need to come round to my house because you don't have any idea about.
So it's good then, Asylum.
It's a film which ends in terrible tragedy, not once. Not twice, but three times.
End in tragedy.
No,
it
does. And by the time it got to the third one, it's like, is there anyone in the cast who hasn't ended tragically yet? Because I really need to go home now. And I'm sure that everyone involved in it is very sincere. And I'm sure they're all trying hard. And it's a shame that they're. I mean, her performance is the best thing in the film. And Ian McKellen's performance is the funniest thing in the film. And the Routemaster bus going past the camera at once to tell you that they're in a 1950s hovel. Let's laugh out loud funny.
Okay, let me give you a covers update, because the green sheets have gone off. Alison, do you know what's going on precisely?
Well, we're going to start, Simon, at 4:05. Too far away, but at the moment, 4:05 is the news we've got.
Just got time for a...
Another film, if you want.
No, I don't think we've got time. That's nearly 4:00 movie of the week.
Well, actually, oddly enough, Cinderella Man, I would say. And I know how unfashionable it is going to be to say that, but oddly enough, Cinderella Man is the film. I like Ron Howard.
Graham Thorpe wants to come in, I think, at this stage.
Well, Mark, I've heard you all about these films going on now for 20 minutes. It sounds extremely fascinating. No, I'm absolutely fascinated.
No,
you've given some stick to some, and you've praised some, and you've knocked some down, and I'd love you to take my book away, Rising from the Ashes, and give me a review of that.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I have to say that I did sneeze over Graham just outside. I felt like I was going to sneeze. I didn't want to do it in here, so I rushed outside, and then I sneezed all over you, and I'm really sorry.
No problem.
Thank you very much. That's very kind.
He's an English cricketing legend.
I know. Well, I'm going to read, and when I've read it, I'll know.
Okay, and then you'll send us your review.
What happens in the end?
Everybody dies.
Okay, there we go. Thank you very much. Will you sign it for me?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, so Mark Kermode asked for an autograph of a sporting legend. Now, that's something. So, movie of the week is Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
If you missed any of the reviews, it's all downloadable via the 5Live website, bbc.co.uk/5Live. What England need is that presenter change, which will happen shortly as Julian Waricker steps into the seat already warmed by Johnny Saunders Bottom. Julian, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Simon.
Once you take over... No, it's been a miserable day. Australia 112 for no wicket. What do you think? Is that
a
good day?
It's not as good as it might have been, is it? Really?
Okay, so Julian with...
You haven't seen last days, believe me. It's been a great day.
I got the impression you didn't like that.
The covers are going back on. Yeah, they got halfway off the pitch, and now they're going back on again.
It's like Rollerball.
Yeah, it is. Gus Van Sant will make a movie of this, and everyone will go...
Julian, you're going to have a great programme.
We're just going to watch covers going backwards and forwards all afternoon, aren't we? It's going to be marvellous.
I can stay. I got more movies if you want.
No.
No, okay.
No, I don't think so. We'll have a news bulletin in just a moment. So, Julian Waricker with you to present Drive, which will be a sort of a mixture, I imagine, of some news events.
I think it'll be a hybrid event, Simon, I think is probably the plan.
Okay. If there is still play on Monday, we're back... here to bring that to you. All the play from the Oval will continue over the weekend, and Julian guiding you through the rest of this afternoon if there is any play, though the covers have all stopped halfway, so they can't decide whether to go on.
Now, aren't they?
It's a cliffhanger.
It is. Tune in to Julian Waricker in a few minutes to find out whether the covers have actually made it onto the pitch. We'll take some news. 4:02.